did not autopsy the anticoagulated rats. Instead, he turned his attention to the original autopsy specimens, the first black Norway rat and the first rhesus monkey to be exposed to the capsule. He performed a complete autopsy on these animals, but discarded the anticoagulated animals. It would be 48 hours before he realized his error. The autopsies he performed were careful and good. He did them slowly, reminding himself that he must overlook nothing. He removed the internal organs from the rat and monkey and examined each, removing samples for both the light and electron microscopes. The gross inspection, the animals had died of total intravascular coagulation. The arteries, the heart, lungs, kidneys, liver, and spleen, all the blood-containing organs, were rock hard, solid. This was what he had expected. He carried his tissue slices across the room to prepare frozen sections for microscopic examination. As each section was completed by his technician, he slipped it under the microscope, examined it, and photographed it. The tissues were normal, except for the clotted blood. There was nothing unusual about them at all. He knew that these same pieces of tissue would now be sent to the microscopy lab, where another technician would prepare stained sections using hematoxylin eosin, periodic acid schiff, and Zanker formalin stains. Sections of nerve would be stained with Nasale and Kajal gold preparations. This process would take an additional 12 to 15 hours. He could hope, of course, that the stained sections would reveal something more, but he had no reason to believe they would. Similarly, he was unenthusiastic about the prospects for electron microscopy. The electron microscope was a valuable tool, but occasionally it made things more difficult, not easier. The electron microscope could provide great magnification and clear detail, but only if you knew where to look. It was excellent for examining a single cell, or part of a cell, but first you had to know which cell to examine. And there were billions of cells in a human body. At the end of 10 hours of work, he sat back to consider what he had learned. He drew up a short list. 1. The lethal agent is approximately 1 micron in size. Therefore, it is not a gas or molecule, or even a large protein or virus. It is the size of a cell, and may actually be a cell of some sort. 2. The lethal agent is transmitted by air. Dead organisms are not infectious. 3. The lethal agent is inspired by the victim, entering the lungs. There, it presumably crosses over into the bloodstream and starts coagulation. 4. The lethal agent causes death through coagulation. This occurs within seconds and coincides with total coagulation of the entire body vascular system. 5. Anticoagulant drugs do not prevent this process. 6. No other pathologic abnormalities are known to occur in the dying animal. Burton looked at his list and shook his head. Anticoagulants might not work, but the fact was that something stopped the process. There was a way that it could be done. He knew that. Because 2 people had survived. 17. Recovery. At 11:47 hours, Mark Hall was bent over the computer, staring at the console that showed the laboratory results from Peter Jackson and the infant. The computer was giving results as they were finished by the automated laboratory equipment. By now, nearly all results were in. The infant, Hall observed, was normal. The computer did not mince words. Subject coded, infant, shows all laboratory values within normal limits. However, Peter Jackson was another problem entirely. His results were abnormal in several respects. Subject coded Jackson, Peter, laboratory values not within normal limits. Some of the results were easy to understand. Others were not. The hematocrit, for example, was rising because Jackson was receiving transfusions of whole blood and packed red cells. The bun, or blood urea nitrogen, was a test of kidney function and was mildly elevated, probably because of decreased blood flow. Other analyses were consistent with blood loss. The reticulocyte count was up from 1 to 6%. Jackson had been anemic for some time. He showed immature red cell forms, which meant that his body was struggling to replace lost blood, and so had to put young, immature red cells into circulation. The prothrombin time indicated that while Jackson was bleeding from somewhere in his gastrointestinal tract, he had no primary bleeding problem. His blood clotted normally. The sedimentation rate and the SGOT were indices of tissue destruction. Somewhere in Jackson's body, tissues were dying off. But the pH of the blood was a bit of a puzzle. At 7.31, it was too acid, though not strikingly so. Hall was at a loss to explain this. So was the computer. Subject coded Jackson, comma Peter. Diagnostic probabilities. 1. Acute and chronic blood loss. Etiology gastrointestinal 0.884. No other statistically significant sources. 2. Acidosis. Etiology unexplained. Further data required. Suggest history. Hall read the printout and shrugged. The computer might suggest he talked to the patient, but that was easier said than done. Jackson was comatose, and if he had ingested anything to make his blood acid, they would not find out until he revived. On the other hand, perhaps he could test blood gases. He turned to the computer and punched in a request for blood gases. The computer responded stubbornly. Patient history preferable to laboratory analyses. Hall typed in. Patient comatose. The computer seemed to consider this, and then flashed back. Patient monitors not compatible with coma. EEG shows alpha waves diagnostic of sleep. I'll be damned, Hall said. He looked through the window and saw that Jackson was, indeed, stirring sleepily. He crawled down through the tunnel to his plastic suit and leaned over the patient. Mr. Jackson, wake up. Slowly, he opened his eyes and stared at Hall. He blinked, not believing. Don't be frightened, Hall said quietly. You're sick, and we have been taking care of you. Do you feel better? Jackson swallowed and nodded. He seemed afraid to speak, but the pallor of his skin was gone. His cheeks had a slight pinkish tinge. His fingernails were no longer gray. How do you feel now? Okay. Who are you? I am Dr. Hall. I've been taking care of you. You were bleeding very badly. We had to give you a transfusion. He nodded, accepting this quite calmly. Somehow, his manner rung a bell for Hall, who said, Has this happened to you before?
Yes, he said. Twice.
How did it happen before?
I don't know where I am,
he said, looking around the room.
Is this a hospital? Why are you wearing that thing?
No, this isn't a hospital. It is a special laboratory in Nevada.
Nevada?
He closed his eyes and shook his head.
But I'm in Arizona.
Not now. We brought you here so we could help you.
How come that suit?
We brought you from Piedmont. There was a disease in Piedmont. You are now in an isolation chamber.
You mean I'm contagious?
Well, we don't know for sure, but we must...
Listen, he said, suddenly trying to get up. This place gives me the creeps. I'm getting out of here. I don't like it here.
He struggled in the bed, trying to move against the straps. Hall pushed him back gently.
Just relax, Mr. Jackson. Everything will be all right. But you must relax. You've been a sick man.
Slowly, Jackson lay back. Then,
I want a cigarette.
I'm afraid you can't have one.
What the hell? I want one.
I'm sorry. Smoking is not allowed.
Look here, young fella. When you've lived as long as I have, you know what you can do and what you can't do. They told me before, none of that Mexican food, no liquor, no butts. I tried it for a spell. You know how that makes the body feel? Terrible. Just terrible. Who told you? The doctors. What doctors? Those doctors in Phoenix. Big, fancy hospital, all that shiny equipment, all those shiny white uniforms. Real fancy hospital. I wouldn't have gone there except for my sister. She insisted. She lives in Phoenix, you know, with that husband of hers, George, stupid ninny. I didn't want no fancy hospital. I just wanted to rest up, is all. But she insisted, so I went. When was this? Last year. June, it was, or July. Why'd you go to the hospital? Why does anybody go to the hospital? I was sick, damn it. What was your problem? This damn stomach of mine. Same as always. Bleeding? Christ, bleeding. Every time I hiccuped, I came up with blood. Never knew a body had so much blood in it. Bleeding in your stomach? Yeah. Like I said, I had it before. All these needles stuck in you. He nodded to the intravenous lines. And all the blood going into you. Phoenix last year, and then Tucson the year before that. Now, Tucson was a right nice place. Right nice. Had me a pretty little nurse and all. Abruptly, he closed his mouth. How old are you, son, anyhow? You don't seem old enough to be a doctor. I'm a surgeon, Hall said. Surgeon? Oh, no, you don't. They kept trying to get me to do it, and I kept saying not in your sweet life. No, indeedy. Not taking it out of me. You had an ulcer for 2 years?
Oh, a bit more. The pain started out of the clear blue. Thought I had a touch of indigestion, you know, until the bleeding started up.
A 2-year history, Hall thought. Definitely ulcer, not cancer. And you went to the hospital?
Yep. Fixed me up fine. Warned me off spicy foods and hard stuff and cigarettes. And I tried, Sonny, I sure did, but it wasn't no good. A man gets used to his pleasures.
So in a year, you were back in the hospital?
Yep. Big old place in Phoenix, with that stupid ninny George and my sister visiting me every day. He's a book-learning fool, you know. Lawyer. Talks real big. But he hasn't got the sense God gave a grasshopper his behind.
And they wanted to operate in Phoenix?
Sure they did. No offense, sonny, but any doctor will operate on you, give him half a chance. It's the way they think. I just told them I'd gone this far with my old stomach, and I reckon I'd finish the stretch with it.
When did you leave the hospital?
Must have been early August, sometime. First week, or thereabouts.
And when did you start smoking and drinking and eating the wrong foods?
Now, don't lecture me, sonny, Jackson said. I've been living for 69 years, eating all the wrong foods and doing all the wrong things. I like it that way. And if I can't keep it up, well, then the hell with it.
But you must have had pain, Hall said, frowning.
Oh, sure. It kicked up some, especially if I didn't eat. But I found a way to fix that.
Yes? Sure.
They gave me this milk stuff at the hospital and wanted me to keep on with it 100 times a day in little sips. Milk stuff tasted like chalk, but I found a better thing.
What was that?
Aspirin, Jackson said.
Aspirin?
Sure. Works real nice.
How much aspirin did you take?
Fair bit, toward the end. I was doing a bottle a day, you know, them bottles that comes in.
Hall nodded. No wonder the man was acid. Aspirin was acetyl salicylic acid, and if it was taken in sufficient quantities, it would acidify you. Aspirin was a gastric irritant, and it could exacerbate bleeding. Didn't anybody tell you aspirin would make the bleeding worse? He asked.
Sure, Jackson said. They told me. But I didn't mind then, because it stopped the pain, see? That plus a little squeeze.
Squeeze?
Red eye, you know.
Paul shook his head. He didn't know.
Sterno. Pink lady. You take it, see, and put it in cloth and squeeze it out.
Hall sighed. You were drinking Sterno, he said.
Well, only when I couldn't get nothing else. Aspirin and squeeze, see, really kills that pain.
Sterno isn't only alcohol, it's methanol, too.
Doesn't hurt you, does it?
Jackson asked, in a voice suddenly concerned. As a matter of fact, it does. It can make you go blind, and it can even kill you.
Well, hell, it made me feel better, so I took it, Jackson said.
Did this aspirin and squeeze have any effect on you, on your breathing?
Well, now you mention it, I was a tad short of breath. But what the hell, I don't need much breath at my age.
Jackson yawned and closed his eyes.
You're awful full of questions, boy. I want to sleep now.
Hall looked at him and decided the man was right. It would be best to proceed slowly, at least for a time. He crawled back down the tunnel and out to the main room. He turned to his assistant. Our friend, Mr. Jackson, has a 2-year history of ulcer. We'd better keep the blood going in for another couple of units. Then we can stop and see what's happening. Drop an NG tube and start ice water lavage. A gong rang, echoing softly through the room. What's that?
The 12-hour mark. It means we have to change our clothing, and it means you have a conference.
I do? Where?
The CR off the dining room.
Hall nodded and left. In Delta Sector, the computers hummed and clicked softly as Captain Arthur Morris punched through a new program on the console. Captain Morris was a programmer. He had been sent to Delta Sector by the command on Level 1 because no MCN messages had been received for 9 hours. It was possible, of course, that there had been no priority transmissions, but it was also unlikely. And if there had been unreceived MCN messages, then the computers were not functioning properly. Captain Morris watched as the computer ran its usual internal check program, which read out as all circuits functioning. Unsatisfied, he punched in the Check Limb program, a more rigorous testing of the circuit banks. It required 0.03 seconds for the machine to come back with its answer. A row of 5 green lights blinked on the console. He walked over to the teleprinter and watched as it typed, "Machine function on all circuits, within rational indices." He looked and nodded, satisfied. He could not have known, as he stood before the teleprinter, that there was indeed a fault, but that it was purely mechanical, not electronic, and hence could not be tested on the check programs. The fault lay within the teleprinter box itself. There, a sliver of paper from the edge of the roll had peeled away, and, curling upward, had lodged between the bell and striker, preventing the bell from ringing. It was for this reason that no MCN transmissions had been recorded. Neither machine nor man was able to catch the error. 18. The Noon Conference. According to protocol, the team met every 12 hours for a brief conference. at which results were summarized and new directions planned. In order to save time, the conferences were held in a small room off the cafeteria. They could eat and talk at the same time. Hall was the last to arrive. He slipped into a chair behind his lunch, two glasses of liquid and three pills of different colors. Just as Stone said, "We'll hear from Burton first." Burton shuffled to his feet and, in a slow, hesitant voice, outlined his experiments and his results. He noted first that he had determined the size of the lethal agent to be 1 micron. Stone and Levitt looked at each other. The green flecks they had seen were much larger than that. Clearly, infection could be spread by a mere fraction of the green fleck. Burton next explained his experiments concerning airborne transmission and coagulation beginning at the lungs. He finished with his attempts at anticoagulation therapy.
"What about the autopsies?" Stone said. "What did they show?"
"Nothing we don't already know. The blood is clotted throughout. No other demonstrable abnormalities at the light microscope level."
"And clotting is initiated at the lungs?"
"Yes, presumably the organisms cross over to the bloodstream there, or they may release a toxic substance which crosses over. We may have an answer when the stain sections are finished. In particular, we will be looking for damage to blood vessels, since this releases tissue thromboplastin and stimulates clotting at the site of the damage."
Stone nodded and turned to Hall, who told of the tests carried out on his two patients. He explained that the infant was normal to all tests and that Jackson had a bleeding ulcer, for which he was receiving transfusions.
"He's revived," Hall said. "I talked with him briefly."
Everyone sat up. "Mr. Jackson is a cranky old goat of 69 who has a 2-year history of ulcer. He's bled out twice before, 2 years ago and again last year. Each time he was warned to change his habits. Each time he went back to his old ways and began bleeding again. At the time of the Piedmont contact, he was treating his problems with his own regimen, a bottle of aspirin a day and some Sterno on top of it. He says this left him a little short of breath."
"And made him acidotic as hell," Burton said.
"Exactly. Methanol, when broken down by the body, was converted to formaldehyde and formic acid. In combination with aspirin, it meant Jackson was consuming great quantities of acid. The body had to maintain its acid-base balance within fairly narrow limits, or death would occur. One way to keep the balance was to breathe rapidly and blow off carbon dioxide, decreasing carbonic acid in the body." Stone said,
"Could this acid have protected him from the organism?"
Paul shrugged. "Impossible to say." Levitt said,
"Well, what about the infant? Was it anemic?"
"No," Hall said. "But on the other hand, we don't know for sure that it was protected by the same mechanism. It might have something entirely different."
"Well, how about the acid-base balance of the child?"
"Normal," Hall said. "Perfectly normal. At least it is now." There was a moment of silence. Finally, Stone said,
"Well, you have some good leads here. The problem remains to discover what, if anything, that child and that old man have in common. Perhaps, as you suggest, there is nothing in common, but for a start, we have to assume that they were protected in the same way, by the same mechanism."
Paul nodded.
Burton said to Stone,
"And what have you found in the capsule?"
"We better show you," Stone said.
"Show us what?"
"Something we believe may represent the organism," Stone said.
The door said morphology. Inside, the room was partitioned into a place for the experimenters to stand, and a glass-walled isolation chamber farther in. Gloves were provided so the men could reach into the chamber and move instruments about. Stone pointed to the glass dish and the small fleck of black inside it.
"We think this is our meteor," he said. "We have found something apparently alive on its surface. There were also other areas within the capsule that may represent life. We've brought the meteor in here to have a look at it under the light microscope."
Reaching through with the gloves, Stone set the glass dish into an opening in a large chrome box, then withdrew his hands.
"The box," he said, "is simply a light microscope fitted with the usual image intensifiers and resolution scanners. We can go up to 1,000 diameters with it, projected on the screen here."
Levitt adjusted dials while Hall and the others stared at the viewer screen.
10 power, Levitt said.
On the screen, Hall saw that the rock was jagged, blackish, dull. Stone pointed out green flecks.
100 power.
The green flecks were larger now. Very clear.
"We think that's our organism. We have observed it growing. It turns purple, apparently at the point of mitotic division."
"Spectrum shift?"
"Of some kind."
1,000 power, Levitt said.
The screen was filled with a single green spot, nestled down in the jagged hollows of the rock. Hall noticed the surface of the green, which was smooth and glistening, almost oily.
"You think that's a single bacterial colony?"
"We can't be sure it's a colony in the conventional sense," Stone said. "Until we heard Burton's experiments, we didn't think it was a colony at all. We thought it might be a single organism, but obviously the single units have to be a micron or less in size. This is much too big. Therefore, it is probably a larger structure, perhaps a colony, perhaps something else."
As they watched, the spot turned purple and green again.
"It's dividing now," Stone said. "Excellent."
Levitt switched on the cameras.
"Now, watch closely."
The spot turned purple and held the color. It seemed to expand slightly, and for a moment, the surface broke into fragments, hexagonal in shape, like a tile floor.
"Did you see that?"
"It seemed to break up."
"Into six-sided figures."
"I wonder," Stone said, "whether those figures represent single units."
"Or whether they're regular geometric shapes all the time, or just during division."
"We'll know more," Stone said, "after the EM.
He turned to Burton. "Have you finished your autopsies?"
"Yes."
"Can you work the spectrometer?"
"I think so."
"Then do that. It's computerized anyway. We'll want an analysis of samples of both the rock and the green organism."
"You'll get me a piece?"
"Yes," Stone said to Levitt. "Can you handle the AA analyzer?"
"Yes."
"Same tests on that."
"And a fractionation?"
"I think so," Stone said, "but you'll have to do that by hand."
Levitt nodded. Stone turned back to the isolation chamber and removed a glass dish from the light microscope. He set it to one side, beneath a small device that looked like a miniature scaffolding. This was the microsurgical unit. Microsurgery was a relatively new skill in biology, the ability to perform delicate operations on a single cell. Using microsurgical techniques, it was possible to remove the nucleus from a cell, or part of the cytoplasm, as neatly and cleanly as a surgeon performed an amputation. The device was constructed to scale down human hand movements into fine, precise, miniature motions. A series of gears and servo mechanisms carried out the reduction. The movement of a thumb was translated into a shift of a knife blade millionths of an inch. Using a high magnification viewer, Stone began to chip away delicately at the black rock until he had 2 tiny fragments. He set them aside in separate glass dishes and proceeded to scrape away 2 small fragments from the green area. Immediately, the green turned purple and expanded.
"It doesn't like you," Levitt said and laughed.
Stone frowned.
"Interesting. Do you suppose that's a nonspecific growth response? Our trophic response to injury and irradiation?"
I think, Levitt said, "that it doesn't like to be poked at."
"We must investigate further," Stone said.
19. Crash. For Arthur Manchek, there was a certain kind of horror in the telephone conversation. He received it at home, having just finished dinner and sat down in the living room to read the newspapers. He hadn't seen a newspaper in the last 2 days. He'd been so busy with the Piedmont business. When the phone rang, he assumed that it must be for his wife. But a moment later, she came in and said, "It's for you. The base." He had an uneasy feeling as he picked up the receiver.
"Major Manchek speaking."
"Major, this is Colonel Burns at Unit 8. Unit 8 was the processing and clearing unit of the base. Personnel checked in and out through Unit 8, and calls were transmitted through it.
"Yes, Colonel?"
"Sir, we have you down for notification of certain contingencies." His voice was guarded. He was choosing his words carefully on the open line. "I'm informing you now of an RTM crash 42 minutes ago in Big Head, Utah." Manchek frowned. Why was he being informed of a routine training mission crash? It was hardly his province.
"What was it?"
"Phantom, sir. En route San Francisco to Topeka."
"I see,"
Manchek said, though he did not see at all. "Sir, Goddard wanted you to be informed in this instance so that you could join the post team."
"Goddard? Why Goddard?"
For a moment, as he sat there in the living room, staring at the newspaper headline absently, "New Berlin Crisis Feared," he thought that the colonel meant Lewis Goddard, chief of the code section of Vandenberg. Then he realized he meant Goddard's Space Flight Center outside Washington. Among other things, Goddard acted as collating center for certain special projects that fell between the province of Houston and the governmental agencies in Washington. "Sir," Colonel Burns said, "the Phantom drifted off its flight plan 40 minutes out of San Francisco and passed through Area WF. Manchek felt himself slowing down. A kind of sleepiness came over him.
"Area WF?
"That is correct, sir."
"When?"
20 minutes before the crash.
"At what altitude?"
23,000 feet, sir.
"When does the post team leave?"
"Half an hour, sir, from the base."
"All right," Manchek said. "I'll be there."
He hung up and stared at the phone lazily. He felt tired. He wished he could go to bed. Area WF was the designation for the cordoned-off radius around Piedmont, Arizona. They should have dropped the bomb, he thought. They should have dropped it 2 days ago. At the time of the decision to delay Directive 712, Manchek had been uneasy. But officially, he could not express an opinion, and he had waited in vain for the wildfire team, now located in the underground laboratory, to complain to Washington. He knew wildfire had been notified. He had seen the cable that went to all security units. It was quite explicit. Yet for some reason, wildfire had not complained. Indeed, they had paid no attention to it whatever. Very odd. And now there was a crash. He lit his pipe and sucked on it, considering the possibilities. Overwhelming was the likelihood that some green trainee had daydreamed, gone off his flight plan, panicked, and lost control of the plane. It had happened before, hundreds of times. The post team, a group of specialists who went out to the site of the wreckage to investigate all crashes, usually returned a verdict of agnogenic systems failure. It was military double talk for crash of unknown cause. It did not distinguish between mechanical failure and pilot failure, but it was known that most systems failures were pilot failures. A man could not afford to daydream when he was running a complex machine at 2,000 miles an hour. The proof lay in the statistics. Though only 9% of flights occurred after the pilot had taken a leave or a weekend pass, these flights accounted for 27% of casualties. Manchek's pipe went out. He stood, dropping the newspaper, and went into the kitchen to tell his wife he was leaving.
"This is movie country," somebody said, looking at the sandstone cliffs, the brilliant reddish hues against the deepening blue of the sky. And it was true. Many movies had been filmed in this area of Utah. But Manchek could not think of movies now. As he sat in the back of the limousine moving away from the Utah airport, he considered what he had been told. During the flight from Vandenberg to southern Utah, the post team had heard transcripts of the flight transmission between the Phantom and Topeka Central. For the most part, it was dull, except for the final moments before the pilot crashed. The pilot had said, "Something is wrong." And then a moment later, "My rubber air hose is dissolving. It must be the vibration. It's just disintegrating to dust." Perhaps 10 seconds after that, a weak, fading voice said, "Everything made of rubber and a cockpit is dissolving." There were no further transmissions. Manchek kept hearing that brief communication in his mind over and over. Each time, it sounded more bizarre and terrifying. He looked out the window at the cliffs. The sun was setting now, and only the tops of the cliffs were lighted by fading reddish sunlight. The valleys lay in darkness. He looked ahead at the other limousine, raising a small dust cloud as it carried the rest of the team to the crash site. "I used to love westerns," somebody said. "They were all shot out here. Beautiful country." Manchek frowned. It was astonishing to him how people could spend so much time on irrelevancies. Or perhaps it was just denial, the unwillingness to face reality. The reality was cold enough. The Phantom had strayed into Area WF, going quite deep for a matter of 6 minutes before the pilot realized the error and pulled north again. However, once in WF, the plane had begun to lose stability, and it had finally crashed. He said,
"Has Wildfire been informed?"
A member of the group, a psychiatrist with a crew cut, all post teams had at least one psychiatrist, said,
"You mean the germ people?"
"Yes."
"They've been told," somebody else said. "It went out on the scrambler an hour ago."
Then, thought Manchek, there would certainly be a reaction from Wildfire. They could not afford to ignore this. Unless they weren't reading their cables. It had never occurred to him before, but perhaps it was possible. They weren't reading the cables. They were so absorbed in their work, they just weren't bothering.
"There's the wreck," somebody said. "Up ahead."
Each time Manchek saw a wreck, he was astonished. Somehow, one never got used to the idea of the sprawl, the mess, the destructive force of a large metal object striking the earth at thousands of miles an hour. He always expected a neat, tight little clump of metal, but it was never that way. The wreckage of the Phantom was scattered over 2 square miles of desert. Standing next to the charred remnants of the left wing, he could barely see the others on the horizon near the right wing. Everywhere he looked, there were bits of twisted metal, blackened, paint peeling. He saw one with a small portion of a sign still intact, the stenciled letters clear, "Do not." The rest was gone. It was impossible to make anything of the remnants. The fuselage, the cockpit, the canopy were all shattered into a million fragments, and the fires had disfigured everything. As the sun faded, he found himself standing near the remains of the tail section, where the metal still radiated heat from the smoldering fire. Half buried in the sand, he saw a bit of bone. He picked it up and realized with horror that it was human, long and broken and charred at one end. It had obviously come from an arm or a leg. But it was oddly clean. There was no flesh remaining, only smooth bone. Darkness descended, and the post team took out their flashlights, the half-dozen men moving among smoking metal, flashing their yellow beams of light about. It was late in the evening when a biochemist, whose name he did not know, came up to talk with him. "You know," the biochemist said, "it's funny. That transcript about the rubber in the cockpit dissolving."
"Yeah, how do you mean?"
"Well, no rubber was used in this airplane. It was all a synthetic plastic compound newly developed by Ancro. They're quite proud of it. It's polymer that has some of the same characteristics as human tissue. Very flexible. Lots of applications."
Manchek said,
Do you think vibrations could have caused the disintegration?
No, the man said. There are thousands of phantoms flying around the world. They all have this plastic. None of them has ever had this trouble.
Meaning?
Meaning that I don't know what the hell is going on, the biochemist said. 20. Routine. Slowly, the wildfire installation settled into a routine, a rhythm of work in the underground chambers of a laboratory where there was no night or day, morning or afternoon. The men slept when they were tired, awoke when they were refreshed, and carried on their work in a number of different areas. Most of this work was to lead nowhere. They knew that, and accepted it in advance. As Stone was fond of saying, scientific research was much like prospecting. You went out and you hunted, armed with your maps and your instruments. But in the end, your preparations did not matter, or even your intuition. You needed your luck, and whatever benefits accrued to the diligent through sheer, grinding, hard work. Burton stood in the room that housed the spectrometer, along with several other pieces of equipment for radioactivity assays, ratio-density photometry, thermocoupling analysis, and preparation for X-ray crystallography. The spectrometer employed in Level 5 was the standard Whittington model K5. Essentially, it consisted of a vaporizer, a prism, and a recording screen. The material to be tested was set in the vaporizer and burned. The light from its burning then passed through the prism, where it was broken down to a spectrum that was projected onto a recording screen. Since different elements gave off different wavelengths of light as they burned, it was possible to analyze the chemical makeup of a substance by analyzing the spectrum of light produced. In theory, it was simple, but in practice, the reading of spectrometrograms was complex and difficult. No one in this wildfire laboratory was trained to do it well. Thus, results were fed directly into a computer, which performed the analysis. Because of the sensitivity of the computer, rough percentage compositions could also be determined. Burton placed the first chip from the black rock onto the vaporizer and pressed the button. There was a single bright burst of intensely hot light. He turned away, avoiding the brightness, and then put the second chip onto the lamp. Already he knew the computer was analyzing the light from the first chip. He repeated the process with a green fleck, and then checked the time. The computer was now scanning the self-developing photographic plates, which were ready for viewing in seconds. But the scan itself would take 2 hours. The electric eye was very slow. Once the scan was completed, the computer would analyze results and print the data within 5 seconds. The wall clock told him it was now 1500 hours, 3 in the afternoon. He suddenly realized he was tired. He punched in instructions to the computer to wake him when analysis was finished. Then he went off to bed. In another room, Levitt was carefully feeding similar chips into a different machine, an amino acid analyzer. As he did so, he smiled slightly to himself, for he could remember how it had been in the old days, before AA analysis was automatic. In the early 50s, the analysis of amino acids in a protein might take weeks, or even months. Sometimes it took years. Now it took hours, or at the very most, a day, and it was fully automatic. Amino acids were the building blocks of proteins. There were 24 known amino acids, each composed of a half dozen molecules of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. Proteins were made by stringing these amino acids together in a line, like a freight train. The order of stringing determined the nature of the protein, whether it was insulin, hemoglobin, or growth hormone. All proteins were composed of the same freight cars, the same units. Some proteins had more of one kind of car than another, or in a different order. But that was the only difference. The same amino acids, the same freight cars, existed in human proteins and flea proteins. That fact had taken approximately 20 years to discover. But what controlled the order of amino acids in the protein? The answer turned out to be DNA,
the genetic coding substance, which acted like a switching manager in a freight yard. That particular fact had taken another 20 years to discover. But then, once the amino acids were strung together, they began to twist and coil upon themselves. The analogy became closer to a snake than a train. The manner of coiling was determined by the order of acids, and was quite specific. A protein had to be coiled in a certain way and no other, or it failed to function. Another 10 years. Rather odd, Levitt thought. Hundreds of laboratories, thousands of workers throughout the world, all bent on discovering such essentially simple facts. It had all taken years and years, decades of patient effort. And now, there was this machine. The machine would not, of course, give the precise order of amino acids, but it would give a rough percentage composition, so much valine, so much arginine, so much cysteine and proline and leucine, and that, in turn, would give a great deal of information. Yet it was a shot in the dark, this machine, because they had no reason to believe that either the rock or the green organism was composed even partially of proteins. True, every living thing on Earth had at least some proteins, but that didn't mean life elsewhere had to have it. For a moment, he tried to imagine life without proteins. It was almost impossible. On Earth, proteins were part of the cell wall and comprised all the enzymes known to man. And life without enzymes? Was that possible? He recalled the remark of George Thompson, the British biochemist, who had called enzymes the matchmakers of life. It was true. Enzymes acted as catalysts for all chemical reactions by providing a surface for two molecules to come together and react upon. There were hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of enzymes, each existing solely to aid a single chemical reaction. Without enzymes, there could be no chemical reactions. Without chemical reactions, there could be no life. Or could there? It was a long-standing problem. Early in planning Wildfire, the question had been posed. How do you study a form of life totally unlike any you know? How would you even know it was alive? This was not an academic matter. Biology, as George Wald had said, was a unique science because it could not define its subject matter. Nobody had a definition for life. Nobody knew what it was, really. The old definitions, an organism that showed ingestion, excretion, metabolism, reproduction, and so on, were worthless. One could always find exceptions. The group had finally concluded that energy conversion was the hallmark of life. All living organisms, in some way, took in energy, as food or sunlight, and converted it to another form of energy, and put it to use. Viruses were the exception to this rule, but the group was prepared to define viruses as non-living. For the next meeting, Levitt was asked to prepare a rebuttal to the definition. He pondered it for a week and returned with three objects, a swatch of black cloth, a watch, and a piece of granite. He set them down before the group and said,
"Gentlemen, I give you three living things."
He then challenged the team to prove that they were not living. He placed the black cloth in the sunlight. It became warm. This, he announced, was an example of energy conversion, radiant energy to heat. It was objected that this was merely passive energy absorption, not conversion. It was also objected that the conversion, if it could be called that, was not purposeful. It served no function.
How do you know it is not purposeful?
Levitt had demanded. They then turned to the watch. Levitt pointed to the radium dial, which glowed in the dark. Decay was taking place, and light was being produced. The men argued that this was merely release of potential energy held in unstable electron levels. But there was growing confusion. Levitt was making his point. Finally, they came to the granite.
"This is alive," Levitt said. "It is living, breathing, walking, and talking. Only we cannot see it, because it is happening too slowly. Rock has a lifespan of 3 billion years. We have a lifespan of 60 or 70 years. We cannot see what is happening to this rock for the same reason that we cannot make out the tune on a record being played at the rate of one revolution every century. And the rock, for its part, is not even aware of our existence because we are alive only for a brief instant of its lifespan. To it, we are like flashes in the dark. He held up his watch. His point was clear enough, and they revised their thinking in one important respect. They conceded that it was possible that they might not be able to analyze certain life forms. It was possible that they might not be able to make the slightest headway, the least beginning, in such an analysis. But Levitt's concerns extended beyond this to the general problem of action in uncertainty. He recalled reading Talbert Gregson's Planning the Unplanned, with close attention, poring over the complex mathematical models the author had devised to analyze the problem. It was Gregson's conviction that all decisions involving uncertainty fall within two distinct categories, those with contingencies and those without. The latter are distinctly more difficult to deal with. Most decisions, and nearly all human interaction, can be incorporated into a contingencies model. For example, a president may start a war, a man may sell his business, or divorce his wife. Such an action will produce a reaction. The number of reactions is infinite, but the number of probable reactions is manageably small. Before making a decision, an individual can predict various reactions, and he can assess his original or primary mode decision more effectively. But there is also a category which cannot be analyzed by contingencies. This category involves events and situations which are absolutely unpredictable. Not merely disasters of all sorts, but those also including rare moments of discovery and insight, such as those which produced the laser or penicillin. Because these moments are unpredictable, they cannot be planned for in any logical manner. The mathematics are wholly unsatisfactory. We may only take comfort in the fact that such situations, for ill or for good, are exceedingly rare. Jeremy Stone, working with infinite patience, took a flake of the green material and dropped it into molten plastic. The plastic was the size and shape of a medicine capsule. He waited until the flake was firmly embedded and poured more plastic over it. He then transferred the plastic pill to the curing room. Stone envied the others their mechanized routines. The preparation of samples for electron microscopy was still a delicate task, requiring skilled human hands. The preparation of a good sample was as demanding a craft as that ever practiced by an artisan, and took almost as long to learn. Stone had worked for 5 years before he became proficient at it. The plastic was cured in a special high-speed processing unit, but it would still take 5 hours to harden to proper consistency. The curing room would maintain a constant temperature of 61 degrees Celsius, with a relative humidity of 10%. Once the plastic was hardened, he would scrape it away and then flake off a small bit of green with a microtome. This would go into the electron microscope. The flake would have to be of the right thickness and size, a small round shaving, 1,500 angstroms in depth, no more. Only then could he look at the green stuff, whatever it was, at 60,000 diameters magnification. That, he thought, would be interesting. In general, Stone believed the work was going well. They were making fine progress, moving forward in several promising lines of inquiry. But most important, they had time. There was no rush, no panic, no need to fear. The bomb had been dropped on Piedmont. That would destroy airborne organisms and neutralize the source of infection. Wildfire was the only place that any further infection could spread from, and wildfire was specifically designed to prevent that. Should isolation be broken in the lab,
the areas that were contaminated would automatically seal off. Within a half second, sliding airtight doors would close, producing a new configuration for the lab. This was necessary because past experience in other laboratories, working in so-called azenic or germ-free atmospheres, indicated that contamination occurred in 15% of cases. The reasons were usually structural. A seal burst, a glove tore, a seam split, but the contamination occurred nonetheless. At Wildfire, they were prepared for that eventuality. But if it did not happen, and the odds were it would not, then they could work safely here for an indefinite period. They could spend a month, even a year, working on the organism. There was no problem. No problem at all. Hall walked through the corridor, looking at the atomic detonator substations. He was trying to memorize their positions. There were five on the floor, positioned at intervals along the central corridor. Each was the same, small silver boxes, no larger than a cigarette packet. Each had a lock for the key, a green light that was burning, and a dark red light. Burton had explained the mechanism earlier.
There are sensors in all the duct systems and in all the labs. They monitor the air in the rooms by a variety of chemical, electronic, and straight bioassay devices. The bioassay is just a mouse whose heartbeat is being monitored. If anything goes wrong with the sensors, the lab automatically seals off. If the whole floor is contaminated, it will seal off, and the atomic device will cut in. When that happens, the green light will go out, and the red light will begin to blink. That signals the start of the 3-minute interval. Unless you lock in your key, the bomb will go off at the end of 3 minutes. And I have to do it myself. Burton nodded. The key is steel. It is conductive. The lock has a system which measures the capacitance of the person holding the key. It responds to general body size, particularly weight, and also the salt content of sweat. It's quite specific, actually, for you. So I'm really the only one. You really are. And you only have one key. But there's a complicating problem. The blueprints weren't followed exactly. We only discovered the error after the lab was finished and the device was installed. But there is an error. We are short 3 detonator substations. There are only 5 instead of 8. Meaning
that if the floor starts to contaminate, you must rush to locate yourself at a substation. Otherwise, there's a chance you could be sealed off in a sector without a substation. And then, in the event of a malfunction of the bacteriologic sensors, a false positive malfunction, the laboratory could be destroyed needlessly.
That seems a rather serious error in planning.
It turns out, Burton said, that 3 new substations were going to be added next month. But that won't help us now. Just keep the problem in mind, and everything will be all right.
Levitt awoke quickly, rolling out of bed and starting to dress. He was excited. He had just had an idea, a fascinating thing, wild, crazy, but fascinating as hell. It had come from his dream. He'd been dreaming of a house and then of a city, a huge, complex, interconnecting city around the house. A man lived in the house with his family. The man lived and worked and commuted within the city, moving about, acting, reacting. And then, in the dream, the city was suddenly eliminated, leaving only the house. How different things were then, a single house, standing alone, without the things it needed, water, plumbing, electricity, streets, and a family cut off from the supermarkets, schools, drugstores, and the husband, whose work was in the city, interrelated to others in the city, suddenly stranded. The house became a different organism altogether, and from that to the wildfire organism was but a single step,
a single leap of the imagination. He would have to discuss it with Stone. Stone would laugh,